This is Darcy Ungaro, and welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast. Whether it's in property, Bitcoin, shares, or business, this is a show designed to equip the everyday Kiwi make better investment decisions. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast is brought to you by podcasts.nz in conjunction with Ungaro & Co. Financial Services. Please remember, none of this is financial advice. We hope you enjoy the show. Hey, I'm your host, Darcy Ungaro, and we're in for a treat today. We have Mike Taylor from Pi Funds coming in. Mike is a humble guy. Humble pie. That's what I'm thinking of with Pi Funds. This guy's good because he's gone through some tough times. He faced the challenges head on. He analyzed the heck out of the situation. He didn't shrink back from it and get discouraged and give up. But in 2008, when things really started going against him, he weathered the storm. He sold furniture. He sold a vehicle. He tried to make ends meet so that he could actually keep the business afloat. And Pi Funds survived that period of time. And not only did they survive, but they thrived. Now we've got a business which is disrupting the market. Their KiwiSaver fund that they launched a few months ago, Juno KiwiSaver, is a fixed fee model. There's no fees charged for balances under $5,000 and kids are free. That's different. No one else is doing that. The bank's definitely not doing that. And he's aiming to take a lot of the business from the banks and effectively reinvent how KiwiSaver is delivered to the NZ Everyday Investor. Check them out. So we hope you enjoy this show. It's going to be a good one. We get into a little bit of detail, but we're also keeping it quite real here. Mike was really honest with us, and it's not very often that you get more than just a soundbite from traditional media, and that's why podcasts are so awesome, because you can actually get a feeling for who this person is. And they're out there, sure, they're in business, they're trying to make a profit, but they're actually doing a social good. And businesses that are aligned with social goods will succeed in the new world. So I hope you enjoy this time with Mike. I certainly did. So without further ado, let's get stuck into it.
So we've got Pi Funds. Underneath that, we've got Wealth. Then we've got traditional funds management. And then we have KiwiSaver under Juno brand. And under the Juno brand, we also have a magazine called Juno Investing Magazine. So Juno is low-cost provider. Pi Funds is high net worth, high service.
Yeah, you've covered both ends of that spectrum.
Yeah.
Yep. No fees for balances under $5,000.
It's kind of like a spark and a skinny type thing, you know, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Is that because that's where you see the growth? The middle is not so much?
The KiwiSaver part is actually, even though it's a low-cost model, it's appropriate for anyone. Because if you've got $500,000 in your KiwiSaver account, you want low cost just as much as someone who's got $1,000 in their KiwiSaver account. And you can deliver that for KiwiSaver in a way that you can't deliver it for the traditional funds management high net worth, is because the KiwiSaver is quite light touch. Right. You're just managing the money. You're not necessarily coming in and giving advice to people.
You're not providing a custodial service.
Correct. You're just, hey, we're just here to manage the money for you. As cheaply as possible.
Which is totally appropriate, because that's the whole idea about KiwiSaver, is that it is low touch and you don't want to fiddle with it once you set it up.
Yep. And as we've seen today about bank profitability, that KiwiSaver is a very profitable operation for banks.
Yeah.
There's currently $500 million in fees being taken from KiwiSaver. It would assume to me that unless the banks change their model, that, you know, there's no reason why that's not going to be $1 billion in fees in a short period of time.
Because it's a percentage based on funds under management.
And that's just growing and it's high margin. So what we do differently is we charge a fixed fee. Mm. So we say, hey, well, it's not costing us any more to manage your money, whether you've got $100,000 or $200,000 or whatever. So the fee's the same. And nobody else is doing that.
Yeah, that's quite a brave move as well, isn't
it?
Because you're kind of setting a cap to a certain extent, right? You have to grow your base of customers.
Correct.
To grow revenue.
Yep.
You have to prove your worth to do that.
Yep.
But it's not just a matter of clipping the ticket and watch your funds under management grow. It's a different model.
And we're also giving no fees for children and no fees for low balances. The reason we're doing that is because fundamentally we don't think the kids should pay fees. I mean, children's accounts at banks.
My kid can't afford it, Mike.
You know, but kids don't pay fees for their bank account.
Correct.
So we don't think they should pay fees for the KiwiSaver account.
Yeah.
And also, if you've only got $1,000 in your KiwiSaver account, you know, you're a student or you've just taken out your money for your first home, you might be paying, theoretically, $60, $70 a year in fees. And if you only got $1,000, it's eating away at your balance. So,
especially if the market flattens out.
So don't penalize people in those situations. So, yeah.
Okay. On the KiwiSaver bet, I've got a friend who signed up his kid with
Juno KiwiSaver recently.
Yeah.
And I drove him home every now and then. We carpool. We live in the same area. And I drove him home. He was telling me the story about how he received an email, or his son received an email from Juno saying, we'd like to reassure you that at Juno, we're prepared for the market drop today. And you went on to talk about how you've been keeping cash reserves aside to accommodate for the fact that markets will inevitably correct at some stage. And when that does happen, you want to be ready to be buying and not to worry if the markets do drop, which some people would worry, wouldn't they?
That's correct. Yeah. Other than just being a low-cost operator, we're also an active manager. Typically, low-cost providers are passive because active management is expensive. You know, you have to employ fund managers and teams of analysts. Normally, with a passive approach, for listeners who don't know, is that you just buy an ETF or you're just buying the market. Whereas an active approach is you employ fund managers and analysts to do research and select individual companies.
You maneuver your investment vehicle according to what the environment is and what you see coming.
Yeah, and part of active management as well is saying, well, just like you said, we can hold more cash than what is typical for a growth fund. So a growth fund is typically only going to have 20% cash, but going into October, we had 60% cash. So that was a big help for us during the month of October.
That must have taken a little bit of bravery, right? Because you're kind of saying, we see some indicators out there and we're so confident that things are going to correct that we're going to incur an opportunity cost. We're going to check out and say, well, we can see things getting a little bit crazy here. The party's getting a little bit too wild. We're just going to step out, remove ourselves a little bit.
Yep.
So part of your foot, 60% of your foot, was out of the door.
Yep.
That takes a bit of guts. It's a risk. Just like, you know, it kind of seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because you are taking a risk by being less risky.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of academics who'd say it's time in the market, not timing the market. But I've been doing this for 20 years, and my experience is you can time the market, and that's how a lot of the times I've gained my outperformance during that period. Is because if you see a storm coming, why are you going to go out with full sails? You know, that's how I see it.
And that's effectively a really good analogy for passive investment. No matter what, we're going fishing today.
Yeah, and that is the downside to passive investment, is you're fully invested at the top. You're fully invested at the bottom, which is good, because often people panic at the bottom, but you're fully invested at the top and you're going to ride it all the way down the hard way. And a good example, so why was I not worried at having that high cash going into October is because I looked at the market and there were a lot of signs or indicators to say that things were getting quite frothy. You know, you just take look at one of the world's biggest companies, Amazon, and you say, well, it was up 100% in 12 months. And that is not sustainable for the world's largest company to keep going up by that rate. So therefore, how much risk was there of it continuing to rally at the same rate? And I say that's a low probability. Therefore, I don't mind sitting out.
And that's a very rational, methodical approach to looking at things rather than everybody else is making money. You know, we really want to make our fund rank really well according to the return.
Yeah.
Therefore, we're going to take on board a lot of risk and we're going to ride this out as long as we can and eke every little bit of return out of the market.
Keep dancing while the music's playing, right?
But exactly.
It doesn't always work. No. Because what happens in markets is when the music stops, there's a rush for the exit.
Right.
And you can't all get out the same small door.
Well said. So you guys have that cash reserve set aside, and when and if the markets do correct, pull back, what's the strategy then?
So, for example, we've already deployed some of that money because whilst markets in general may be off about 10%, some of the technology sectors off a lot more than that.
Yeah.
I think Amazon itself fell 25%. So that's a reasonable enough correction for us to say, okay, we'll put a bit more money to work now.
Yeah.
The froth's come out.
So going back to the active and passive piece, active management does get distilled down to that core belief that you can, to a certain degree, time the market.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, as well, active management tends to be a proponent for stock pickers. So stock pickers will say that, you know, regardless of the direction of the market, I can pick companies that will do well regardless.
Sure.
So that's part of it. It's not just about asset allocation, cash versus equities versus bonds. It's also about picking your investment.
Gotcha. So you get right down to the micro level. It's not just switching asset classes and changing that mix. It's about going down.
Yeah, I mean, think about it in terms of property. You might say, well, is the street going to do really well? And then someone will say, well, I'm going to pick the house on the street because I know that that will do better.
Good analogy. Insurance. It's kind of like insurance as well, isn't it? You know, you're paying slightly higher fee for active management, but in times like this where there's a little bit of volatility and a changing environment, you're paying for someone to be at the steering wheel.
Yeah. Well, then the case with our KiwiSaver, you're actually not paying more. You're paying less.
Yeah, which I'm still boggling over that. How do you cover your costs? How do you actually build a business like that?
So, you know, we consider ourselves a SaaS business in terms of KiwiSaver and a disruptor.
Okay.
And what you do as a software as a service business or a disruptor is you go and do things differently to the way people have done them before. So that for us is to do low-cost active management. And so therefore, when you want to disrupt, you need to take market share. And so that's what we're setting out to do is to take market share predominantly off the banks.
Good.
We've got a, depending on whether you incorporate some of the providers who are partly owned by banks, but it could be sort of up to 80% of the industry is controlled by banks and large insurers. You know, they're ripe for disruption.
Yeah, especially at the moment.
It isn't easy, yeah. Although you'd be surprised how apathetic consumers are, is that you can sometimes say to them, hey, look, I can save you $100,000 over the next 20 years in fees. And the response might be, yeah, but I don't really give a shit, you know.
Yeah, or it's like I love seeing everything on my app. You know, I can go to my one app and I can scroll down. I can see my KiwiSaver there. I can't be bothered changing. You know, I'm sure I'm going to save $100,000, but I love seeing it on my app.
Yeah, and I think now hopefully if there's more messages come out about how actually banks aren't really working for you, that we're kind of working against you, we'll start to realize that, well, trust in the banking sector will diminish, I think. It already has globally. So
it does feel like the trust factor has gone down. Especially with reading the headlines this week.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it hits New Zealanders equally, whether some demographics will receive that message and kind of get turned off by that whole thing quicker than other demographics.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess, you know, Gen X is Gen Ys and younger.
Yeah.
Would probably be quite repulsed by the profits being generated at the moment, I'm going to guess.
Yeah.
Not a good look.
Yeah.
Whereas the older generation are probably much more... They take a lot more comfort and security in the fact that the bank is big and they've always been there for me and I'm loyal, they'll take care of me.
Yeah, there's a big difference in attitudes towards that type of thing, as well as investing. We've noticed is that, you know, how the younger generation is much more willing to invest in an ethical fund or a climate-focused product, whereas the older generation doesn't really care about that because it's not impacting them more than in the latter years of their life. So
it's so interesting,
what,
isn't it?
Right?
That whole move for ESG, you know, that whole ESG, environmental, social, good governance. But that whole trend seems to be much more about this rising social conscious, this voting with your dollars. Your investment is more of an outworking of who you are.
Yeah.
You're voting almost rather than investing for a return. You're kind of picking that up with the younger generation, especially?
Definitely. I mean, get this, here's a really good example of future thinking. So I said to my son, would you eat meat that was grown in a lab? And he's nearly 11. And he said, yeah. And I said, oh, you wouldn't be repulsed or disgusted by that? And his answer, unprompted, was, well, if I do that, then that means we don't have to kill animals.
Wow. Unprompted, you didn't kind of...
I did not prompt him at all.
You're not a vegetarian yourself?
Not a vegetarian.
Yeah.
So he's saying he'd be happy to eat meat grown in labs so we didn't kill animals. And so if that's the view of his, you know, the younger generation coming through, then we can expect quite a lot of change in the next 20 to 30
Amazing,
years in terms of how we care about the environment, how we invest ethically,
correct,
all that type of thing.
So what's it going to look like in 10, 15 years' time when our kids get older? And they reflect on how we built our wealth. Will they judge us for investing in big oil, you know, traditional pharmaceuticals?
Of course they will. They'll be saying, I can't believe you guys invented plastic. Or, you know, what were you thinking?
So if you want your children to love you...
change your attitude.
Amazing.
Yeah. The same way we look back and say, I can't believe the Holocaust happened. I can't believe we allowed that to happen. But it happened.
Yeah. That's right. So what about other factors? So I'm seeing, because we see a lot of people that are in the first home buying space and they're looking to buy their first home. And over the last 5 years, they've been turned off because of rising house prices. They've been locked out of the market.
Yeah.
Are you seeing a rise of the younger generation, especially getting into investments because they've been locked out of the traditional spaces?
I think buying your own home is always going to be that sort of sweetheart dream that people will always want, right? In New Zealand and Australia specifically, probably Canada as well, but some other countries where renting is a way of life. You know, if you go to Europe,
That's right.
It's the norm. Yeah. But here, people think that it's a birthright to be able to own a home. So unless that changes, I think people are always going to think, I want to save and get my first home. And yeah, they are using KiwiSaver, for example, as a way to build up a deposit for their first home. It doesn't seem to be thinking of, oh, I'm using KiwiSaver kind of as an investment vehicle.
As a means to an end.
Yeah, it's more to get the home.
Correct. That's right, yeah. It's like, and I don't know if this is the beginning of it, and time will tell, but I wonder if the rising house prices, that whole piece, I wonder if that's going to be exactly what New Zealanders need to reframe or recalibrate how they look at investments, because property seems to be number one go-to in terms of building wealth. It's not the only way, but 1987 probably is still lingering in the minds of many of us.
Yeah, and the problem is as well is that property has been such a great passive investment for the last 30 years.
The ultimate. Yeah.
Just buy and hold, and there's a generation of people who just think that I need to do nothing, just buy it and it'll go up. And what they don't seem to realize is that since 1983 or whatever it is interest rates have fallen from 20% to 4%, and that is the main reason why your property valuation has gone up. That and migration.
Yeah.
You've had the huge yield pickup, and because interest rates can't really go any lower.
Where to from here?
Yeah.
I guess it could just slowly converge to zero, right? That would be interesting.
It could. Well, I mean, if there's another recession and New Zealand's forced to do QE or something like that.
And what would that look like? That would just be insane, wouldn't it? Because you can only go so many places when you're at 4%, right?
Yeah.
Well, we're talking about retail. But
yeah, retail, I guess I probably, unless you're in Switzerland, you're never going to get to borrowing rates of zero. I think probably the lowest we'd be able to get to might be 2.5 to 3.
Yeah.
So there's not much left
to go. And when you think about where we're at in the cycle, if we're at a peak or if the peak has just been,
yep.
Interest rates normally should be kind of high right about now or right before now.
Correct,
and normally they'd fall from here. But we haven't really got much more of a floor to go to or much more headroom to work within. So it would be, I guess you could say we're a bit more vulnerable this time around in that sense, right?
Yeah, I think they spent too much time worrying about what the currency would do as if they hiked rates.
Mm.
And instead of all the other measures they put in place to tighten the property market, like banning foreign buyers and, the LVR requirements, if they just focus on traditional methods, in my view, like raising interest rates, we'd have a bigger buffer now.
That's right. Just let the market take care of itself.
And we could have had rates maybe instead of at 4, maybe at 6.
Yeah.
And they'd have a cushion for the next recession.
God bless Adam Smith.
We got no cushion now.
That's right, yeah.
So the next recession will probably be, depending on the government, debt to GDP I just saw is 20.8% today,
right.
I think, relative to where everyone else is. We could easily do a deficit spend to stimulate.
Okay.
We could do a kind of a Chinese-style shock and awe 10% budget deficit to get us out of the next recession if we wanted to.
Yeah.
So we have that ammunition. We also have QE. So we've got a lot more tools in the toolbox to still use.
Right.
Whereas you look at the US, they've already got a massive budget deficit next year at the peak.
Yeah.
So where do they go?
Exactly. And that's it's scary when you think about it.
Yeah.
So what do you see happening then? So pivoting over to that piece, if we're at that point where maybe what we're seeing in the last few months, these little jitters in terms of the markets, if that's just the precursor to some pain coming up ahead, how do you see that unfolding? If you were just to throw some ideas on there, what you see happening in terms of the next crisis, what would that look like if there was something nasty?
By and large, this is another kind of credit-led growth cycle. You would need to see a tightening of credit again to lead to a recession or problems like that. However, it's not a financial crisis this time. We don't have over-leveraged banking and financial institutions. So don't look in the same places we looked last time. It would be my first point of advice. The second thing is that the market has actually fallen this year, not because of Trump's rhetoric. It's fallen because of interest rate spikes. So interest rates spiked in January. They spiked again in September.
You're talking about
the Federal Reserve's, the US 10-year.
Yeah, sure.
That has spiked.
Yeah.
And both times, that's what's been the catalyst for the correction.
Okay.
But on the flip side, why are they spiking? It's because the US is booming.
Somebody's making America great again.
Somebody is.
Not me.
What's it, drain that swamp? What is drain the swamp?
Drain the swamp. I've never been able to figure out what that means.
What swamp?
Well, I don't know, but you're going to find a lot of skeletons in there, I think, if you do.
Yeah.
I don't know, cars.
So, yeah, the US is adding 250,000 jobs a month. Unemployment's at 4%. The economy is running hot. They have raised rates over there. They've got a little bit of a cushion, not much.
At the expense of everybody else, they're doing great.
They're doing great. Correct.
Yeah, they're emerging markets have really suffered as a direct result of that.
Yeah, so emerging markets have suffered as a result of higher rates in the US and a strong US. China's suffered as a result of the trade wars and sentiment overall. I mean, emerging market equities, which include China, are in a bear market.
Mm.
So they're down 25% since the peak in January.
Yeah.
You know, it may be okay here in the US, but elsewhere there is already pain out there.
Yeah. So do you see that the days are finite in terms of the U.S. story? Because am I correct in assuming that you're saying watch what's happening maybe in the U.S. to see, look for cues?
I think what the Fed's trying to do is give themselves a little bit of a buffer because they know what's going on fiscally.
Right.
So thinking, well, that's there. We've got to give ourselves a buffer because we need to be able to cut rates by 2 or 3% to stimulate again.
So they're trying to create a bit of a war chest.
So they're trying to do that gradually because they do know that they'll choke off the economy at a certain point. Hard to know what that level of interest rate rising is, but important to note that the Fed has killed every recovery since Second World War. So they've got to go really slowly. One of Trump's comments with the Fed was loco recently. Yeah. Is that I'm not saying that I agree with that, but I do think the Fed probably needs to go a little bit slower than they are because there's a danger that they'll just choke it fast.
Correct. Yeah. They choke it fast, then they're basically strangling the golden goose.
Yep. Yep.
So in terms of New Zealand with things that, you know, the everyday Kiwi should be worried about, you shouldn't worry about anything, just chill out, relax, okay. Go to the beach, have a good summer. But as an investor, you know, thinking about the next 1 to 2 years especially, what would you say to the average everyday investor that's looking to de-risk a little bit? For whatever reason, what's the smartest way to do that?
Markets are cyclical. Anyone who tells you otherwise hasn't read the history books. This time's different at the top, and the cycle can last longer. And you know, maybe there's a sideways movement for equities, and it's in moving in a range of or properties the same. Maybe it's sideways.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee, and we shouldn't always expect this paranoia of there must be a crash. Right. That doesn't have to happen. You can have a revaluation adjustment by 5 years of sideways prices.
It's on pause until the fundamentals catch up and it actually makes sense.
So that's another option.
Right. And the risk with things being a bit boring for 5 years is that people start to get into more higher risk investments and they start to get bored and make dumb decisions, right?
Yeah, although I'd probably think they'd get shaken out in between is that, you know, if we have a 15% move, well, lots of volatility, people get shaken out.
Sure.
That's typically what happens. Yes, it's great to look back and say, okay, the corrections from 2000 to 2003 and 2008 to 2009, oh, that's easy. The market's going to fall 50%. I'm just going to be out for that period. I'm not so sure we're going to get that playbook this time.
Sure.
Maybe it's sideways choppy. Because one thing I would say is if the equities drop 25%, the Fed's going to stop raising rates. And then market will stop being paranoid about higher rates. And
things will readjust.
Things will readjust. So,
Yeah,
there. You know, there's so many different permutations and combinations that can happen.
Gotcha.
But going back to your question, is what should people do? Is that recognize that markets are cyclical and that we're more likely near the end than we are at the beginning of the cycle, and that, you know, if you haven't already, you should have been making some adjustments to your portfolio. Yeah. I'm going to say this: is that if you're in passive, you're in the wrong place at this time in the market.
Good on you, Mike.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you said it.
Yeah.
But it's good, though, because if no one's at the steering wheel, you're on autopilot, and you're heading into a storm.
Yep.
Well, it's probably already too late, because by the time you can see it, it is too late, right?
Yep.
And you don't know what you don't know until you get there. And then, of course, you had a perfect strategy in hindsight. So 2007 is when you started Pi Funds, correct?
Yep.
And you started that. Tell me the whole thinking around why you wanted to do that. What was the genesis of that idea?
Of my baptism by fire.
Yeah.
So I go back to Massey, you know, when we were both there at a similar time, 98, and I was the guy ducking out of lectures to put trades on, kind of the dot-com era, and buying technology businesses then. Got a $3,000 student overdraft, which you could take at the National Bank, and then I realized that wasn't enough capital. I needed to borrow $10,000 from my parents, which gave me strict payment, to pay back $1,000 a month with 10% interest.
Wow. Good parents.
Yeah. Good financial discipline. So yeah, I had 13 grand of capital, and that's what really got me started. And then I just really loved it. But I, unfortunately, even though I wanted to straight out of university, just go like a full-time day trader, that was my dream. I realized that still didn't have enough capital and that I probably had to get a job. And so I got, you know, jobs, various different jobs. First graduate job was in banking. And then that wasn't right because I was in credit and I wanted to be in trading.
Right.
So I moved to equities and foreign exchange trading for a period of time. And then kind of that fast forward to 2006. And sort of actually over the in between years, so from 2000 to 2007, friends and family noticed that I was quite good at what I did.
So that 13,000 that you had way back when?
Yeah.
Still, I did grow there, or did you?
No, so by the time I'd started Pi, I'd grown that to about 250,000 in capital.
Awesome. Yeah.
So friends and family were like, you know, this is going pretty good. You know, Mike's good at what he does. So first my parents gave me a little bit of money, then my sister gave me some, and then dad's friend, someone else, and then one of my friend's parents, and so on and so forth, until I had about 10 people and about $3 million.
Right. Is that right?
And capital that was just by 2007. Some of that was gains and some of that was just the capital. I compounded my money at about 45% per annum from when I started until 07. And everyone was like, this is awesome. If you start a funds management business, we'll roll our $3 million in and we'll tell all our friends and we'll get you some new clients and you can turn it into a legitimate business. And I thought, yep, this is good. What do I need to make this work? Probably $20 million. I'll just be the only employee. You know, it'll just be me in a room like this.
In a
padded cell, yeah. I actually had this windowless office.
Right.
There was a tiny little strip at the top and it had bars on it. It was like an old IRD building or something where they used to put people who didn't pay their returns. The yeah. And that was my like padded room. Yeah. So I went in there. But what happened was because I left my job and started 2007 to get this set up. I was ready to go by December. Took some time to get regulated, etc.
Yeah.
And then the first month of operation, I lost 10%.
Right.
That was difficult to take.
Right.
As you can imagine. So I couldn't get any new clients. As 2008 rolled on, it became, there's a few people who might have joined through that year, but it got harder and harder, and I kept losing money. And so I didn't have much to do during the day other than sort of just study and analyze. And so I spent a lot of time analyzing bear markets because I knew we were in one. And I bought this book called The Anatomy of the Bear, published in 07, I think.
Okay, The Anatomy of the Bear.
Anatomy of the Bear.
Cool.
I started cashing up the fund and recognizing that cash was a really good way to protect your money rather than trying to use complex derivatives or buying defensive stock. So it was just take the
fund. That was your option. So your only option to hedge was just to hold cash reserves, really.
Yeah, you could have used derivatives, futures and options and things, but I thought, let's just use cash.
Yeah.
And then I can say to investors, look, the maybe dozen or 15 who were there, the fund's in cash. Even in saying that, after Lehman's went, you know, equities were probably down 60%. I was still down 30.
Okay.
So, I was half the fall,
yes,
but
good.
Still lost people a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they weren't happy.
No.
Okay. It was pretty hard so to go to the...
those bars in the window came in pretty handy then.
So my son was born in February 08, and I remember some of those kind of early catch-ups with family and the barbecues and things. And
awkward.
Yeah, people were like, well, how much money have you lost me? And there were a lot of difficult moments and navel gazing and thinking, you know, why have I done this? My parents said, you should never have left the bank. I later told them that the bank I was at went bust. I was at Merrill Lynch and they got bailed out. So I probably would have lost my job there anyway.
Yeah. Never had anyone tell their story of how they started with such honesty. You know, like normally you skip out those horror stories and you just say, I was a freaking genius. And
It was brutal.
It was hard, was it?
It was, I put, of the 200 something grand, I put in half of that into capital into the business to fund things, which then kind of subsequently took out for wages for myself and a few other things. But probably by June, I talked to the other directors and said, look, I just can't, there's no money left. I can't pay myself. We had two cars. We sold a car and then we just cut expenses. We went into austerity mode,
yep.
Cut expenses, write back. We sold a stereo. We sold some other furniture on Trade Me and kind of raised, I guess, I don't know, 30,000 to 35,000 to just see us through for a period.
Yeah.
That was very challenging.
To say the least. I'm picking up that it was even worse. It was a tough time, was it?
Yeah. And so fast forwarded to kind of March 09, actually, and in a pretty dark place. And then there was a change in sentiment in the market. It was pretty hard to pick up if you weren't right finger on the pulse, because believe me, people remained bearish for a long time after 09. I think it would have been 5 years. I saw poached clients that were still negative. But in that period, so the fund was 80% cash, and I basically stabilized everything by Lehman. So from October to March, even though the market kept falling, we didn't fall. This client called, he's now a director, actually, literally like the day of the bottom, and he goes, oh, are you putting any money in the market? And I said, oh, don't be ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's only one day. And he goes, yeah, but maybe it's changed. And so I thought, well, maybe it has changed. So I went back to my anatomy of the bear, and I developed these indicators to say, because there's about 10 I came up with, and I call them traffic lights, and I put them in my newsletter and everything. And I said, you know, actually, you know, things are changing. Maybe we're at a bottom. So by April or May, I can't remember the exact date, I was fully invested.
Wow, you redeployed all that cash.
I redeployed all the cash.
Yeah.
And by June, I had all these indicators telling me everything was green. I should be fully in the market. And there was still so much pessimism around.
Interesting.
And of course, that's what, you know, bear markets are born on, pessimism, right? So that year, I made 105%.
Wow.
In equities.
And that was 09.
09.
Yeah.
So made up the 30 that I'd lost from the year before and put on some gains as well.
And you were away again.
And I was away again.
The wind picked up.
The wind picked up.
Yeah.
I could pay myself again.
Yeah.
$3 million became $7 million under management.
Yeah.
New clients came. People were like, oh, look at this guy, Mike. He's made money when everyone else is, because people by the end of 09, they were still down.
That's right.
I mean, I remember a lot of managers, if you're in a passive fund,
just putting it out there.
You know, it might have been 6 years until you got back to break even.
Yeah.
From the peak.
That's right.
Or more. You know, people who are in passive funds in the .com, they went all the way down, they got back to where they were by 2007, and they'd start again.
Yeah.
So,
it's really easy to say that paying extra fees to be inactive is a waste of money when the market's really exuberant and there's been quite a few years of those gains, because you can just say, well, why bother when everything rises on a rising tide? Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
But your whole business went through this period where you were challenging the platform, going through some really tough times, but it was the analysis, the research, the hard work that you put yourself through that set you up for massive success later on when it happened. And if you didn't go through that, you could say that none of that success would have happened to a certain extent, right?
Agreed. Yeah. And, you know, part of the reason why fast forwarding to today is I'm so quick to be in cash is because of the experiences I had in 2008. And sure, you know, maybe we've given up some upside over the years because we have carried more cash than we probably needed to. But if you look at our long-term results, we're still ahead of benchmarks and everything. So I say, well, not really, you know.
Yeah.
If we can outperform in up years and massively outperform in down years, then we're doing what we're paid to do.
Okay, good. Now, the other parts of the business that happen right now, we've got a wealth advisory business.
Yep.
And then just pure funds management, right?
Pure funds management, we have direct retail clients. Started the wealth side because lots of clients need advice.
Okay.
So we're kind of migrating some of our existing client book over to getting financial advice, as well as bringing in new clients.
And the team is growing. In terms of the advisory business, is that something that you see growing in coming years, more of a need for advice for people, say, $500,000 plus that want to invest? Is that a growing space?
Yeah, it's our fastest, other than KiwiSaver, it's the fastest growing part of the business at the moment. So we have two financial advisors now, and we'll expand that.
The other part of the business is effectively just what you just create funds. Is that how it works?
So we have 10 products in PIE. And they do different things. So there might be a global equity fund. We've got a UK fund. We've got four that do Australasia. One hedge fund. We have an ethical climate fund.
Yeah.
So different products for different people.
So with Juno KiwiSaver, would some of the funds be going into those funds?
No. So the KiwiSaver's three separate products: growth, balance, conservative.
Yeah.
The same investment team, but they have a different focus.
On the private wealth part of the business, they're more open to the market, right? So they can work across, not just...
Correct. So they may allocate to non-PIE funds products,
yeah.
Unlike the banks, who will only allocate to their own products. If we see products out there that we don't cover,
yeah.
we might buy a bond or whatever covers that aspect. Okay. Yeah.
Now, you referred to software as a service business, and that's what you see the Juno KiwiSaver as a software as a service business.
Yeah.
What do you see in the next, say, 5 to 10 years in terms of innovation? Do you see that the model that you're currently working with, do you see that evolving much?
So that could come into the general funds management business as well. It started a little bit overseas and kind of a watch the space in terms of us as to whether we do that. But the logical move and why we're doing it in KiwiSaver is that's what we believe suits the KiwiSaver market is a software as a service, a subscription fixed fee amount for what you pay for your KiwiSaver.
Yeah.
It will be very hard for the incumbents to change their model. It's kind of like Airbnb comes in and how does Sheraton react? They can't just change their model, right?
That's right.
So what happens is that the market expands a bit. That means maybe more people join KiwiSaver, so the market will expand and the traditional players lose market share.
Things get bigger, more players in there, and that effectively displaces the competitors out there that are offering a percentage fee model versus...
So at the moment, there's 2.8 million in KiwiSaver. Look out 5 years, maybe the market's expanded to 3.5 million. The market share that the banks have will have dropped from where it is today.
Are you guys going to be getting into anything else, or are you mainly, strictly speaking, going to be sticking to the investments?
There's nothing in the pipe, but it's never say never.
All right, now we're approaching the end of our time together, Mike. So I just wanted to thank you again for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. Is there anything that you wanted to impart or share? Anything else that you want to cover?
Just to talk about, investing in general, I think would be a good thing to spend maybe 5 minutes on. Investing is not easy, but it doesn't need to be hard. And I realize that's a bit of an oxymoron. But a lot of people think making money is easy because they've been in the market's gone up, their property's gone up. Well, this is easy, anyone can do it, right? But they don't realize, as we said earlier, that markets are cyclical and things can go down. Yeah. But when I say that it doesn't need to be hard is because a lot of people, even investment professionals, overcomplicate things is what is a relatively simple thing that you need to do is that you're trying to buy an asset that you think will go up in value.
Right.
That's what you're trying to do. Pretty simple. Mm-hmm. So you need to make a common sense assessment is this asset expensive or is it not? Is it a fair price? And, over the years... I found that, which is why I like the book One Up on Wall Street, another one I recommend reading. By Peter Lynch.
Okay.
He was one of the best ever fund managers, and his style basically was that he'd buy businesses in the States that, he'd say, buy a business that any idiot can run, because sooner or later any idiot will run it. It was just like so easy, when Walmart first started, how could this not work? How could this business not grow? I can think of examples in New Zealand we've had is that, you look at, say, the warehouse when that first started and what they was doing. It was just, they're rolling out stores. This is working. It's full. It's obvious. This is going to go well. Hmm. And anyone can do that by just walking into a warehouse.
And see it.
Yeah. Zero accounting software is you can see that, and I know at some point it had a very egregious price, but in the beginning you can say, well, look, everyone's moving to this online accounting software, so it's got good odds it's going to work. And so that's why I went from $1 to $45.
Because people often will attribute a certain sort of mysticism around choosing, but it's really simple, isn't it?
And other things, it's like, I wouldn't suggest, this is a little bit different now because Apple has saturation, but go back to when the iPhone was first invented, right? So this is, I got my first in 08 or 09, somewhere around there. Now, listen to that. This is revolutionary. And everyone was saying, who was it? I think it was Nokia or someone else.
BlackBerry.
BlackBerry. It's like, oh, no one's going to buy these, right?
Yeah.
But when you use your first iPhone, you're like, this is going to revolutionize the world. And so you just make an investment decision based on common sense.
It's really not that complicated.
It's
like
not.
You say. It doesn't. It's not easy, but it's also not hard.
Yeah. What you're saying. So, you know, that's why I say anyone can be an investor. But when you start to complicate things and say, you know, oh, what do I think, you know, the growth rate of this company is going to be? Is it going to be 5% or is it going to be 7%? And what are the interest rates in the US going to do? And start getting all these other complications in there. That's when it becomes too hard. You know, I'm sure it's the same because I'm not a property investor, but I'm sure it's the same with property is that, you know, let's say, you know, buy the worst house in the best street and, you know, all those kind of things. It's just, I guess my point is that it's not easy because there's lots of pitfalls. You can succumb to emotions, all that kind of thing, but don't make it hard for yourself.
Yeah. Well, it was one thing that really, we had Lance Wiggs from Punakaiki Fund on the show maybe a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And that was what came out there is that, you know, even as an angel investor, investing is work. It's not just throw money at something and the money does the work.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last point to make is that it's never too small to start. So I started with that $3,000 exactly 20 years ago. And, you know, I look at what I've achieved in 20 years. And sure, maybe people won't go down my career path to get there. But it means that they can turn their $3,000 into a significant sum if they've got a long enough time period. Yeah. Don't try and do it in 6 months.
Yeah.
But if you've got a long time horizon, you can start with $3,000 and you can add to that every month. You can start with a tiny amount of money.
Yeah.
Don't think, oh, I haven't got $100,000, so I can't start. Everybody can be an investor.
I've written all this down. That's good.
That's good. Now I'm done. Yep.
You're spent. That's it. All right. No, I really appreciate it again. Thanks, Mike, for coming in. Now, if people want to find out a little bit more about what Pi Funds does, or KiwiSaver in particular, where can they go?
So if you want to find out about our great KiwiSaver offering,
yeah,
you can go to junokiwisaver.co.nz. That's J-U-N-O. And if you want to find out about Pi Funds and our financial advice and wealth offering, it's pifunds.co.nz.
Sweet. Awesome. Thanks again, Mike. Really appreciate your time. Okay, so thanks again, Mike, for joining us today in the studio to discuss what Pi Funds is up to, what they're all about, and Juno KiwiSaver. Now, what's the biggest risks coming up? Most people in this space believe that there is change coming. There is a change in the direction of the market. We may have already entered into a bear market, and that does have some implications for the everyday investor. What do you do? Do you short sell some stocks and get into some complex derivatives? Do you just keep cash reserves aside? Do you change your strategy completely? Well, you know, the more you play with something, the more likely you'll get into trouble. This is what I tell my 8-year-old boy anyway. Just don't touch it if you don't know how it works and what the implication is. There's a big difference between active fund management and passive fund management. Mike clearly sits on the active side of the spectrum, and we've had other people on the show equally as enthusiastic about passive investment. So what's the deal with that? And why would you want to be in an active fund at the moment? Well, for me, what I can see is that clearly it's a form of insurance. You are going to pay more for it, but think about the environment that we're heading into. Have you ever seen so much change going on? Anyway, that's it. So we hope you enjoy that time that we had with Mike. Now, if you're a fan of the show and if you like what we're doing, we're starting to see some really positive comments. So thank you very much for those who are listening. Take the time out to actually comment. Really appreciate that. Keep it coming. But if you're a fan of the show, then I want you to check out Patreon. Go over to Patreon, search for NZ Everyday Investor. You'll see us there. And if you want to support what we're doing, then do it. We're all about improving financial literacy. We're trying to get information out of the ivory towers and into the laps of everyday Kiwis. Can you help us? We'd love your support. So head on over to Patreon, search for NZ Everyday Investor, and if you can support us, we'd really appreciate it. So until then, hope you enjoy the show. Catch you next time around.
You've been listening to the NZ Everyday Investor, brought to you by podcasts.nz in conjunction with Ungaro & Co. Financial Services. I've been your host, Darcy Ungaro. Please remember to subscribe to the show, and if you'd like to learn more about what we've covered today or any of our guests, please visit us on Facebook. The NZ Everyday Investor contains information and content designed to get you to think about your investment decisions, but none of this is financial advice. Thanks for listening in, and we'll catch you next time around.